broadcasting around the world on International Shortwave and on the Radio Disclosure Radio Network. I'm your host, Matt Aaron, and we've got a cold show for you tonight. My guest is going to the Arctic Circle soon. At least, that's what he says. And not only is he going, but he's already been there. This guy has been in contact with NASA. You know, I'm a photographer. I like taking photos. But he just told me something about his equipment that he's taken up there. It just blew me away. I got Wilbur Allen, PhD. Hey, Wilbur, welcome to the program. And how are you?
Thank you for having me, Matt. I'm doing very well. How about yourself?
I think I'm doing great. Been dealing with the spam phone calls all night. And I'm kind of glad that I turned my phone off and now I'm on the radio, so I don't have to hear my phone ringing constantly. So tell us about yourself.
My name is Wilbur Allen. I have a PhD in Advanced Imaging Systems from Howard University. I did my research specifically in Advanced Hubble, and for my degree, I created an Advanced Hubble system. And most people who are not familiar with Hubble, which is in orbit right now, Hubble is a 16-bit, 1600 ISO orbital application designed specifically to look into space at 350 nanometers, which is not quite infrared. It's near infrared, and it also looks into space at normal perspectives, which is generally 2700K and 5000K at 1600 ISO, at rather 800 ISO. So I created a system initially for my PhD, which was ISO 204-800, which exceeds NASA's Hubble technology, 1600 ISO, significantly. And initially, the application was designed specifically to look into space, not necessarily space as in outer space, but space as in our upper atmosphere. And I created a lens application, which allows me to look into a particular area of inner space in infrared and record that particular area of inner space at 60 frames per second, which is considered motion picture for most people who don't understand cinematography, especially high-speed cinematography under nocturnal conditions. But the application allows me to shoot 60 frames per second at 1/250th of a second shutter speed in absolute darkness, in a range of 450 or 470 nanometers to 110 nanometers, which is specifically ultraviolet, infrared, and X-ray. So I'm looking in space in these three bands of non-visible light and generating samples of spatial anomalies on a consistent basis using the applications that I developed.
So, folks, I want to step back for a second. You just released so much information about what it is you're doing. It's quite phenomenal. Okay, so a standard Canon DSLR camera, that's what I shoot on. There is no infrared, unless if you take it and modify it. And who's going to modify a $600 camera? Yeah,
But see, now keep in mind, I just modified $8,000 cameras. And the $8,000 camera with ISO 4 million is generating results unlike anything NASA has. And keep in mind, I'm filming high-speed nocturnal motion picture at night and at 60 frames per second and getting samples in one fixed region of space constantly, which, you know, when you start thinking about constants, when you deal with astronomical objects, and when you think randomness associated to meteors and comets and things of those nature, and when you start getting those things, which are supposedly random, constantly on a nightly basis, then those random objects are no longer random. They've taken on a sense, an air of consistency, and the frequency suggests that the air and consistency of frequency associated to these objects, that these objects have infiltrated our airspace.
Whoa. What do you mean by
that? I went beyond the explanation with your camera, by the way. But, you know, when you think about it, you can take conventional technology and that technology could be used specifically. For example, I'm using D5 Nikons and soon to be D6 Nikons. And I take the D5 Nikon, which is a full-color night vision camera, and it does a great job during the day also because it has a 4 million ISO capability. And I modify it for full-spectrum infrared, so it allows me to see ultraviolet, infrared, and X-ray specifically, and I can put the filters in the lens that I created called the Hyperstar lens. And with this particular camera and lens modification, I'm seeing what NASA says does not exist, or what NASA has yet to exist. But I'll take that back. NASA has documented these things from the space station. But, you know, NASA on board the space station, they're using GoPros for their visual video technology, and all the astronauts have a GoPro snap to their spacesuits. But, you know, the space station itself has no actual imaging technology. It does no surveillance at all.
So what kind of things, when you say anomalies, are you seeing?
I have to mention Operation, or rather Project Echo, which is 8/12/1960, and Grumman ground satellite tracking technology. And Grumman ground tracking technology documented these anomalies in our atmosphere, and they describe the anomalies as spanning from state to state. Now, wait a minute, how big is an object that spans from state to state? It's pretty huge. So they documented these three specific anomalies in our inner atmosphere, and these inner atmospheric anomalies were these streaks of light, and they're consistent. They're streaks of light. They weren't the same length. They were various lengths of light, but they were all red and or white. And NASA, during Project Echo, noted that this surveillance satellite that they launched in orbit, which is as big as a house, bigger than an apartment building, technically speaking, was being followed by these anomalies, and they documented them. And this is 8/12/1960. The same objects documented 8/12/1960 was last documented 3-4 nights ago in the airspace that I do research currently, which is in Virginia. So it says without a doubt that these objects, which the U.S. government does know about, are still here. And they know that without a doubt. And what they call shooting stars, they're not shooting stars, they're spacecraft.
So those streaks that we see across the sky, and when they say there's meteor showers, we're actually...
When the meteor does a 90-degree turn, is that a meteor?
Oh, no, no, not at all. You can't... I've seen some of these that do like curlicues sometimes in the night sky.
Well, that could be consistent with their structural dynamics. You know, I mean, we're talking about a ball that's coming into the atmosphere and it's spinning. It can do like when you throw a baseball and it has a curve associated to it. Mm-hmm. That curve associated to it is generated by the spin that you put on the ball as you throw it. So we're talking about an object spinning. But these objects that I'm getting have uniform consistency. There's no spin associated to them. It's a streak of light, and you can see that the streak of light is being powered. And what's interesting is their power, the matrix associated to their contrail, is all uniform and consistent. It's either green or red. And the camera system technology that I generated that is in the 4 million ISO range is documenting these objects.
So I take my camera out in the backyard at night, and I have a Canon T3i, and I have a T1i, and I've been out to Area 51, and the listeners know this, and I take my cameras out there, and I'll do time-lapse photography at least once a year, and I've got some very interesting photos from Groom Lake. We've done a couple live broadcasts from out there. It's quite amazing what you can see out there. Your camera system is insane, so... For the average person that is wanting to get into photographing some of these, what would you suggest to them?
High ISO cameras. And keep in mind, you mentioned Area 51. I was a cast member to a show on country music television called My Big Redneck Vacation. And My Big Redneck Vacation sent me to Area 51 with the Clampets. And Clampets, just like the Beverly Hillbillies, these rednecks whose last name is Clampett own America's largest natural gas deposit. So they are indeed real billionaires we're dealing with, not just rednecks. But the objects I documented in Area 51 started following me. And I've got samples from Area 51 in 2013, taken in November. And 2 months later in Sedona, Arizona, which is in a state right next to it, I document the same object, which, by the way, it told me to film it telepathically, and it instructed me where and when to set up the camera, and I did, and I documented it.
I'll tell you.
And it followed me. It followed me from Area 51.
I'll tell you my experience out of Groom Lake. We had, we were out by a big sand dune in what I call my hidden area out there. And these big red fireballs lit up the sky. It was like looking at a stoplight. It lit up the ground. It scared me. And I looked at my brother and I said, let's get out of here. And he's like, no, man, we're going to stay. I'm like, no, let's get out of here. It scared me. Like,
did you get pictures?
Oh, yes, I did.
Do you know, I took pictures also. And based on our actions, that technically was against the law, because specifically in that area, it said no photographs. Now, wait a minute. Are we talking about Area 51, the base, or the airspace above it? See, they have no control over the airspace. So that's what was interesting about what I was doing. And people were talking about the legality of taking photographs in and around Area 51, which specifically says no photographs. I didn't take pictures of the base. I took pictures of the airspace. And in the airspace, there are UFOs.
Yeah.
I agree with you.
Yeah, it's all over the place out there. And I will tell you, by no means, I'm on the other side of the extraterrestrial highway. I'm not on the Groom Lake side. So where I was taking photographs and all of that, I would definitely consider that being legal. When we come back from the break, do you have any more Area 51 experiences that you want to share with us?
I will tell you a story that will make your hair stand up.
All right. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Radio Disclosure. When we come back, he's going to make the hair stand up on the back of our heads with another Area 51 story. This is Radio Disclosure. Welcome back to Radio Disclosure. We got Wilbur Allen, PhD. He's been to the Arctic Circle, going to go back. We're going to talk about that in a little bit. But before the break, he promised to tell us a creepy, crazy story of Area 51, which is a favorite pastime of myself. So what you got there, man?
Well, I'm telling you, I was in Area 51, and I'm not talking about outside the perimeter. I'm talking about in an area that was specifically marked no photography. And I'm sitting there with a tripod and a camera, a 200-millimeter lens aimed at space, and I'm snapping pictures, something telepathically, and using abstract wordage tells me to pack my blank and leave immediately. And I said, I stopped immediately. I was startled just to hear that. And just to hear that thought prompted me to pack my blank and leave immediately. And within 2 minutes, a armed Jeep with two security personnel that had a machine gun mounted on the top of it drove into the area where I was set up to take these photographs and make things even stranger. I knew I was being followed, so as we left that area to the hotel that I was staying, which was 100 miles from Area 51, I set up my camera in the courtyard, and I was recording video, and I said, and I knew I was being followed, okay, show yourself to me. And within 10 seconds, it appeared on video, flew through the frame, and then vanished.
Oh my gosh.
And I've got that on video.
That would... Yeah, that would creep me out.
It's a tic tac.
What is a tic tac?
The object's documented by the Nimitz.
Keep going. I don't know what you're talking about.
The Nimitz, the USS Nimitz, in 2004 encountered anomalies in the sky. And the anomalies they encountered in the sky, you know what a Tic Tac candy looks like, the little Tic Tacs?
Oh, yeah.
It had the shape specifically of a Tic Tac, except much larger. It had capabilities. Let's just say it blew a U.S. Navy F-18 out of the water in terms of speed. The F-18 couldn't keep up with it. F-18. So we know, without a doubt, you must Google USS Nimitz, USS Nimitz encounter, and look at the objects encountered. I sent you that link. It was, I believe, chapter 28. But the objects encountered by the USS Nimitz, which showed these tic-tac-shaped organisms, and I say organisms based on my research because I've generated 3,000 samples associated to this specific anomaly, and this energy-based organism has capabilities. It can fold space. I mean, it does things like appear and disappear. I've documented all of its capabilities, and there's no possibility for any man-made object, forward flight technology, to possibly take on these objects. Impossible.
So the question that I would pose is how common are these?
Well, it was initially documented out near San Diego, which was a naval exercise being conducted by the aircraft carrier, the USS Nimitz, and the Nimitz Admiral, by the way, is on my page on Facebook. What's interesting?
What is your website and your Facebook for the audience out there?
For people, Wilbur Allen, UFODC.com, PhD is my Facebook, and my website is UFODC.com.
And I've been
and you can go UFO.
I was up there, and folks, I'm going to tell you, there's a lot of information up there, and
tons, 9,000 bits of data, high definition data, 9,000 bits.
Yeah, give the website out again, please.
UFODCDavidCharlie.com.
And if I remember right, you also have a donate page, a donate button up there, folks. His work is important.
Yes, I do.
His work is important.
Yes, I do. And I'm self-funded. What money I do make when I do these television shows, I put right back into technology. I constantly update. And, you know, I'm the type of person, I go out and do UFO research. I'm not going to sit here and talk about other people's work because, you know, other people do their things. What I do is specific to my degree. And what I do specific to my degree is scientific data. And the scientific data I'm generating is, you see the quality of it on the samples that I've sent you. It's indeed superb.
So Tic Tacs. I've never heard this term before. I know you sent me some stuff and I read through it a little bit, but the average listener may have not have heard again of these things called Tic Tacs. And
you can Google that Tic Tac UFO, the USS Nimitz, and we're talking about US Navy personnel who stepped forward to tell people what they encountered in the ocean. Now, we're talking about extraterrestrial objects, and people don't want to believe UFOs are real. And here are naval professionals, Navy professional people, professionally trained Navy personnel, telling you they encountered extraterrestrial technology that blew away F-18s and blew away Nimitz and Aegis cruiser technology, which can track anything, anywhere on Earth. These things made the Aegis cruiser technology go haywire.
See, these are... What do you theorize these things are?
Nuclear-based organisms. I say nuclear-based because I've got samples of these objects materializing and dematerializing. What's interesting is I'm telling you I'm filming 60 frames per second in absolute darkness. So that means for every second of action, I get 60 frames of photographs, 60 frames. And those 60 frames I'm photographing at 1/250th of a second. So we're not looking at blurs or, you know, most people try to say that the streaks of light I'm getting are the results of extended duration exposures. Impossible. 60 frames per second is not an extended duration. And 1/250th of a second most certainly isn't a slow exposure, especially for nocturnal applications. And the objects that I'm getting, and keep in mind the lens technology that's connected to this camera. I took a Celestron telescope, the 1100 and the 1400 series telescopes, the Edge HD, and I inverted them, meaning I removed the primary mirror, which is the front mirror of the telescope. Most people who have a telescope look through the back of the telescope to look into space.
Right.
I removed the primary mirror and put what's called a hyperstar converter there. And the hyperstar converter allows me to place a camera directly in the front of the telescope looking into the tube at the secondary mirror, which is this large mirror placed at the back of the telescope, the optical tube assembly.
That's incredible.
The larger mirror, and keep in mind, the primary mirror at the front of the telescope is a 5-inch mirror, a small 5-inch mirror, while the secondary mirror is a 14-inch mirror. So I'm now looking at space through the inverted side of the telescope at a 14-inch through a 14-inch mirror at f2.
Oh my
gosh. It's like if you're into nocturnal photography and you want to do really good nocturnal photography, your limits are f2.8.
Right.
Beyond that, it's not usable, but below 2.8, f2, 1.8, 1.6, 1.4, 1.1, you've got pure night vision. You've got a lens that can gather the light that is there under the conditions in which they're being, in which you have the camera focused on. So with a fast lens and with light gathering capability, you're able to see things which you won't be able to see at f4.5, f5.6. Anything beyond that, you can't use at night anyway. It makes things too dark. It's just not fast enough
right.
to absorb light. So for the Hubble application that I created, what I did was I created this inverted telescope, and at the front of it is where the equation changes considerably, because the D5 and the D6 Nikons are 4 million and 8 million ISO. ISO 204-800, for example, which is much higher than most people can get with any of their conventional consumer-based cameras. At 204-800, I'm getting 60 frames per second at 1/250th of a second. In high speed, we're talking high-speed nocturnal motion picture and generating samples of objects that incrementally materialize, which I call incremental manifestation into the airspace, meaning as they materialize into the airspace, and I'm filming 60 frames per second, every second of that, you could see this thing like Klingon cloaking technology as it decloaks and cloaks itself. You could see it incrementally manifest and incrementally dematerialize out of the airspace. And I've documented that. And the interesting thing is that is inconsistent with NASA's research associated to spatial portals. NASA's research associated to spatial portals was based on conjecture, and they were theorizing that aircraft, boats, and people that disappeared along the Bermuda and Alaska Triangle disappeared primarily because of deviations in the magnetic field. While my data indicates, and I'm not near those areas of these deviations in the magnetic field. I'm in Virginia. And in Virginia, I'm getting objects materialized and dematerialized, and that's not consistent with NASA's research. What the data does indicate is that these objects have technology which allows them to fold and unfold space at their will. They can come and go anywhere on this planet, not necessarily just limited to the Alaska and Bermuda triangles. And again, I'm mentioning my pool of research right now in this current location I'm in is in Virginia, and I'm 3,000 miles away from the area in which the USS Nimitz, actually 4,000 miles from where the USS Nimitz documented these Tic Tac objects, and I'm getting these objects on a nightly basis in Virginia.
So
I also got them in Washington, D.C.
So there was a guy that discovered that if you take a camera, like a video camera, and block out the sun but shoot right across the sun, that you would see these spinning objects all the time. Are these kind of the same?
I know the guy you're talking about, and I had to go a different direction. I looked directly into the sun. I use solar lens technology, and solar lens technology is a little bit different. If you know anyone who has a solar telescope, you can look directly into the sun and not burn your eyes out like you would with a conventional lens.
Right.
Well, and I did indeed create a solar lens that was based on Hubble.
That
is the applications associated to it, and I have samples to that also.
That's incredible. His website, folks, is ufodc.com. ufodc.com. Go up there, take a look at it.
When we come back, I'm going to see if we can't talk about some of the Arctic Circle projects he's been doing. There's a base there. He says it's confirmed. We'll be back. This is Radio Disclosure. Welcome back to Radio Disclosure. I'm Matt Aaron, your host, talking with Wilbur Allen. His website is UFODC.com. That's UFODC.com. This guy has invented technology to photograph UFOs like no one else has. He blows me away right now. Like, okay, I am a camera buff, and I've been a camera buff for a long time. I've even posted a lot of my photography online. You guys know that I just love it as a hobby. Some of the ISO and the I'm very jealous. And he's going out to the Arctic Circle soon. And I'll be honest, I'm very jealous because I know what kind of photography you're going to be able to do while you're out there. But that's not the primary reason why you're out there. Now, you have two times you went out there. Do you want to talk about your previous experience being down in the Arctic Circle?
I was working a show which I provided content for called Missing in Alaska, which is on the History Channel. I provide content for sci-fi shows, by the way, UFO shows, rather. And they sent me to the area called Mount Hayes, Alaska, which we talked about earlier. And since the 1950s, for some odd reason, American and Russian satellites would malfunction immediately after passing over Mount Hayes, Alaska. And then once they go out of range of Mount Hayes, Alaska, they reorganize themselves or reboot themselves and start functioning again. So we know for a fact, and I went out there the first time to do some research, and I went to the top of Mount Hayes, and it was, and we talked about this, it was 83 below zero, and we had just hiked. Keep in mind, glaciers are ice mountains, and this particular glacier, the angle of attack in which we had to take to go to the top of this particular mountain was approximately 45 degrees, a 45-degree inclination. And you're talking about climbing up a mountain of ice at a 45-degree angle, so we had to use shoes that had steel spikes so that we could spike our footsteps into the ice itself. But on the way up, what was really abstract is that it's 83 below zero, and as we got to the top of Mount Hayes, we all had to strip because we were sweating like pigs in minus 83 below zero weather. And most people think that's cold, but you have to think about cold like dry ice cold. Dry ice cold is not the same as a humid cold, like a cold in Atlantic City or a cold in Maine or, you know, a cold in Chicago. That's because of the water and it's just moist and it's damp cold. A cold in the Arctic Circle and cold in the Antarctic Circle is completely different. It's more like cold fusion in a sense where it's no longer, you don't feel cold anymore. It feels summertime. And it's minus 83 below zero.
I wonder if that's because
the logic behind that.
I wonder if that's because there's no conductivity between your skin and the actual air because everything is so frozen.
Well, I don't know, because when we were climbing the glacier, what was interesting, I swear we passed through a layer of particulates that appeared to be frozen cloud matter. It was like, you know, do you know how fog, when you see fog, mm-hmm. and fog is water particulates that are suspended, while these water particulates were frozen solid. It was very interesting, and they were still suspended, like in a layer, and we walked through that. And what was interesting, and I have to tell you that when we went through that, all of my samples photographically changed color. As
really?
If, yeah, I have a series of shots going to the glacier where everything is color balanced. And once we pass through this layer of particulates, I would call some kind of frozen cloud matter of some sort, everything turned green as if we were encompassed by aurora borealis. It was absolutely abstract. And the aurora borealis is another thing. I don't know any natural phenomena that responds to commands. And I was in a shack in the North Pole, and I saw aurora borealis above the shack. And I said, okay, move left. And it moved left.
What?
It moved left.
That,
on command.
That is crazy.
Absolutely. Is it an organism or is it a phenomena?
So something interesting you said to me before was, in this area, there's absolutely no radio communications in or out.
Nothing. Nothing. And I just mentioned to you, any satellite passes over, goes dead, and then comes back to life once it's out of range of this particular glacier. So we're assuming it is some type of directional magnetic field. And we talk, magnetic fields are not directional. Magnetic fields are omnipotent. They go multiple directions, but whatever these extraterrestrials have, it is directional. And it stops whatever goes directly above it. There is no clear scan of Mount Hayes, Alaska from space. No one has it. Why? Because they can't.
So there's another area on the Earth that I'm aware of that has some of the same strange anomalies. They call it the Zone of Silence in Mexico.
Yes.
And they have theorized, there's been people that have theorized this, that there's some kind of alien base there. In the alien yes. base, any kind of object that's supposed to hit the Earth, because multiple objects, as far as meteorites, large, small, so on and so forth, have all hit within that one area, as if somebody were guiding them there. Now, I don't
know. Exactly. Targeting, yes.
So you would need something to control that other material, magnetics or whatever. I mean, a lot of these rocks are so full of metals and such, when they come and hit, they hit hard. And
yes,
and they're full of metals and stuff. But you say that there's definitely a base there. And it's
yes.
you say it's been confirmed. Can you get into that some more?
Since the 1950s, you can Google spatial anomalies associated to Mount Hayes, Alaska, and it'll show you, tell you the research associated to that area. What they don't tell you is the military research associated to that area. The military spent for years trying to conduct research to see what was causing that, and because of the level of technology, that, again, that's what I was bringing up in reference to the USS Nimitz and their 480p FLIR. 480p is not quite 4K. 480p is 1/10 the size of a 4K file. So keep that in mind. So we're talking about 4K full color infrared versus 480p FLIR. And the 480p FLIR, in my opinion, showed, and it, because it was monochromatic, keep that in mind, we're not talking full color, so you didn't see the actual qualities associated to the anomalies that they documented, but in full color, what's interesting about the objects, and that is one of the reasons why we're going to Alaska, the North Pole, with this specific type of technology, is that in documenting these Tic Tac objects, for example, and I've got 3,100 examples of them, and each of the examples, not one of the Tic Tacs, based on the samples that I've able to gather, can be matched within sample of Tic Tacs that are documented. So I have 3,000 Tic Tacs, all of which are unique in terms of how people have different faces and how everything is different, like human-wise. These objects, the only thing that's consistent about them is a sort of uniform shape, but what's even more interesting is their propulsion systems. And in the 3,000 samples that I've documented, and in each sample, which I've documented from beneath the object as it passes through the frame of the camera, the lens, in each of the samples, the objects show what appears to be a clockwise rotational energy field around them, which is constantly in rotation. And it appears, based on the film samples, it appears to have the qualities of microbes as they undulate. Undulations are the movements associated to microbes in a petri dish. If you look in a microscope and you look at these microbes as they move, they undulate. It's like this wiggling that they do to get from one side of the dish to the other. And what's interesting, there's a statement, and I know most people understand this, and I'll make this rather simple. It says, as above, so below. As above, so below. So I have these huge alien objects which undulate in space, and they show this clockwise modulating energy signature. And here in this petri dish are microbes and viruses which have the same uniform characteristics. The differences are, of course, microbes are microscopic, and here are these objects in space which are macroscopic, huge, as big as an F-18 in a size comparative in nature. So as above, so below. And I compared the petri dish virus and microbes to these anomalies that I'm getting in space, and I could almost say that they're cousins. Oh, they're consistent.
So that brings up my whole next thought that I kind of have. I mean, you have these things like that, but like you think of the solar system, our solar system, and you think of the galaxy, and then you think of an atom, and you start thinking about things in nature. There seems to be this repetitive nature that it has. Let's see, I used the word nature again. It has this like repetitive thing that it has with it, where things look similar all the time. Until you get into quantum physics. Now that's a whole other level of oddity that, yeah, I won't even go there.
But wait a minute, hold that thought. As above, so below. So we're talking about shapes and designs unique to the microscopic world, the shape of an atom or the shape of a molecule. And here in space are larger objects, alien objects in nature, that are uniform and consistent with things in the microscopic world, however, operating along what I believe to be a nuclear level of consistency. Because for an object to be able to appear and disappear, and meaning with this lens that I have, if it's cloaked, I can still see it because its outline is present in the airspace. But when these things vanish, there's nothing. They're gone. There's nothing there. So it indicates that without a doubt that whatever they are, they're nuclear in nature, because only an object with sufficient energy, and that would be nuclear, would have the ability to offset time and space.
That's incredible. When we come back from the break, we're going to continue this conversation. Nuclear aliens living right among us. This is Radio Disclosure. Welcome back to Radio Disclosure. Aliens that go in and out of our existence, nuclear powered. Wilbur Allen, PhD, his website is ufodc.com. He's got a donate button up there. He's got an expensive habit, and that's definitely photography and you said earlier that, and this just occurred to me as I was sitting here thinking about this. This isn't like pie in the sky. This isn't like, hey, we have these out here and I'm just going to tell you about it and blah, 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 blah. You said you had 3,000 photographs of these things.
What makes this all interesting is I left Washington, D.C. in 2017. I had been doing research in D.C. I was hired by country music television to do my big redneck vacation. I'd mentioned they sent me to Area 51. So after my big redneck vacation and after Sedona, something prompted me to set up my cameras on my roof. So I would line up my cameras north, south, east, west alignment and film 90 degrees directly above my home. I do that everywhere I go. It's all aligned north, south, east, west, and 90 degrees above where my specific location is. So it's not like I'm looking for anything. And that's what makes this all interesting. It's like when you go to an ice fishing hole and you use that one little hole on a daily basis. And on that, in that little hole on a daily basis, you catch the same fish. What are the probabilities of that? It's like astronomical, especially when you're talking about probabilities associated to astronomical objects, meteors, comets, shooting stars, what they call shooting stars, which in my opinion are extraterrestrial spacecraft, initially documented by Grumman in 1960.
Now hold on, back up. You're saying shooting stars are spacecraft. Like when we see these things, they're just spacecraft.
Yes. And the government, U.S. government, especially during Project Echo, which was 8/12/1960, has known about them. They've documented them constantly. And Grumman created this camera array, which, you know, if you know anything about photography, which you do, and we're talking about analog film, however, not digital, analog film. If you knew anything about analog film, 35 millimeter was one thing. 2.25 was another. 4x5 was a completely different ball game, and 8x10 negatives were the bomb. So Grumman created these cameras, which were 4x5 cameras at 1600 ISO using Kodak HIE film, which is infrared at 550 nanometers. And with this 4x5 camera at 1600 ISO, Grumman was able to document space and see the stars without, you know, when you start taking pictures with low ISO cameras or smaller format cameras, and you want to take pictures of stars, and you have to sit your camera in the tripod, and you got to do a 2, 3, 4, 5 minute exposure just to get that right amount of light so you can see the stars. But as you do this 3, 4, 5 minute exposure, the stars are also streaking through your photograph. But at 4x5, at the 4x5 frame size, Grumman was able to take and film these spatial anomalies during Project Echo, which was 8/12/1960, and film these objects using shutter speeds that were prohibiting that distortion associated to a prolonged exposure, meaning like if I did a 3 or 4 minute exposure, you'd see the streaks of light associated to that.
Right.
Grumman was taking pictures at 1/160th of a second, 1/130th of a second. And with the larger format camera, able to see clearly see the space because it's a large format, they weren't getting stars like I'm getting stars at 200,000 ISO, but they were getting stars based on this large format 4x5 negative. And in this large format 4x5 negative, they documented these streaks of light, three of them. One was, as they described, spanned from state to state. So that would be, God, how big is a spacecraft that spans from state to state? Huge. The second one was 3/4 the size of the larger one, and the third one was half the size of all three that were documented. Now, what's interesting, we're talking about three specifically shaped and length objects. With my infrared camera, I documented an event in which this smaller red streak of light materialized. It didn't fly into the airspace. It materialized into the airspace, flies through, and then a millisecond or two later was a much larger red streak of light following it, and it was already in the airspace, so I was able to document that. What was interesting is when I did a comparative to my sample and the comparative to the samples taken by Grumman, 8/12/1960, the data specifically says we're looking at the same objects. They were the same lengths. The differences, of course, are my technology is 64-bit and 4K high definition showing these objects with clarity. And here's this 1960s 4x5 1600 ISO color infrared, or rather black and white infrared HIE negative, showing these objects, which they knew were red because they saw them. They saw them as red objects. Now, 2 weeks ago, on board the space station, an astronaut documented what they said was a red laser attack at the International Space Station, but what was supposedly a red laser attack was one of the red streaks of light that I documented on a consistent basis. And what makes this interesting is the ISS, International Space Station sample, ISS, I did not mean ISS, ISS sample, is 100% consistent with data that I have right now. 100% consistent. It wasn't a red laser that shot by that space station. It was a red spacecraft.
You know, let's back up for a second on the whole NASA thing. So, to get a laser to hit the International Space Station from where we're at,
you'd have to have at least a 10,000 watt laser.
Not only that, but your aim would have to be more than perfect.
More than perfect. But keep in mind, and here's where I have a problem. Satellites, and let's just change from the space station to satellites. A satellite is the size, perhaps, and smaller than a jumbo jet engine. And we're talking about this small object and the space station are in orbit at 250 miles. People telling me that they can see satellites. Now, wait a minute. If humans' visual range, specifically a human, his range is ISO 0 to ISO 800 at night, is 1 mile.
Yeah.
If your range is 1 mile, how are you telling me you can see a satellite 250 miles in orbit?
Yeah,
you see my problem?
Yeah, yeah. And sitting out in my backyard, I have noticed just this massive, and when I say massive, I mean like uptick. Now, when I was a kid, we used to go out in the backyard with the redneck lights, and we would shine them up in the sky, and then, you know, the next day or so, there would be reports of UFOs in the area. That's documented. We've done that multiple times. And we would get flashes that would flash back at us, and some of them would pulsate like 3 times. Some of them would flash and move. Some of them so bright that it would send chills down your spine. But here's the thing. As of recent, I have seen so many more objects in the night sky. And they go from this extreme brightness, and then they get lighter and lighter and lighter. Now, I've tracked the ISS multiple times. I've supposedly hit them with my ham radio talking to them as well. Talk to some of the astronauts up there. But what's interesting is looking at the trajectory of the ISS and how in its speed, some of these objects I see in the sky are almost 3 times faster than what the ISS is moving. Say again?
10 times faster. 10 times faster. 100
oh, yeah.
times faster.
Yeah. And
so, that's the one thing we're talking about. You're saying you could track this, and what's interesting. And I'm going to guess you were tracking it during either sunset or sunrise, because any other time is impossible. And that's where I'm having problems with people. They're saying, okay, so I saw the space station at sunset. So you're telling me I can't see it? You can't see it. What you're seeing is the sun reflected off the space station.
Right.
You can't see the space station. It's a glimmer at that point. So we have a problem, a semantic problem, associated to what you can see and what is being seen. If you see something at sunset or sunrise, you are seeing whatever that object is being reflected by the sun. So you're seeing sunlight, not the object itself. So you
right.
have to be more specific. If you're going to tell me you saw the satellite, that is a lie. You did not see the satellite. You saw the reflection of the sun.
Well, and I'm going to step back on you for a second on that one, because the space station size versus a satellite and the amount of reflectors that are on the space station versus a satellite,
it would still be impossible to see if there was no sunlight associated to it. Now, the objects I'm getting in space, and keep in mind, I'm shooting at night. That means the sun is bright on the opposite side of the planet. There's no sunlight there. And it's impossible for something in space to get sunlight because light does not bend. It's a, and in a, where the sun is not shining and the planet is to the opposite side of the sun, anything in that space in the dark is invisible.
Yeah.
You can't see it. There's no light source to illuminate it, unless, of course, it's self-illuminated. Now, and here's what's interesting, too, and people tell me, oh, I can see satellite. If it's self-illuminated, it's not a satellite.
Makes sense.
Satellites have no source of illuminations because their power sources are limited. They need the power sources on board those spacecraft to operate the technology they have. A light would be a depletion of energy that's unnecessary. Why would they put a light on a satellite?
Yeah, because what are you going to do? Light up, you know, you're going to put grounding lights on it to show where you're going to come down at? Yeah, come on.
Yeah, it's not logical. UFODC.com, folks.
Get up there. There's a donate button. He's going back to the Arctic Circle. He's going to bring a whole bunch of technology. He's going to go back to the base there and try to bring back more evidence. This guy has more evidence on his website. See, that's all of this we're talking about tonight, it's on his website. You can find video evidence of it. Real evidence. Go up to the website, radiodisclosure.com. This will be posted as a podcast shortly after it's aired. And if you're listening on a local station, thank you very much to the local station. I want to say thank you to WTWW, the International Shortwave Station, for also carrying us. Thank you for listening. This, ladies and gentlemen, is Radio Disclosure.